The call to peaceableness. Matthew 5. Jesus' words, "You have heard that it was said to the men of old, 'You shall not kill.'" It is about a year ago that an English motorist, enraged by an obscene gesture made to him by a pedestrian, turned his car round and drove like fury onto the pavement, ran over the pedestrian and killed him. That's the capacity of anger when it's let off the leash. An undisguised tit for tat, paying off of a grudge. It's a spirit, I suppose, that keeps the Northern Ireland conflict going over all these years, that feeds the turbulence in the Lebanon, that prolongs the agony of Cambodia, Sri Lanka, or Iran. Here in the Sermon on the Mount, we're presented with another way of living, a lifestyle and a standard of goodness which promised the Galilean speaker as he stood overlooking the lake below him, will finally outlast the empire of hatred and revenge and overwhelm it. Robert Powell, the actor in Zeffirelli's televised Jesus of Nazareth, said after the experience of playing the part of Jesus, "When we did the Sermon on the Mount, it was with Moroccan film extras who couldn't understand a word. The setting was superb and I got carried away. The beauty of the words and ideas when spoken aloud are overwhelming. Halfway through I started crying. We filmed the whole 8-minute speech without stopping." Robert Powell went on to say, "You can read the words in the Bible, but when you come to say them aloud, it's something else. They are electric." Yes, these luminous words have been the building blocks for whole societies of people. They've acted as a mirror image and model for the aspiring believer. Is there somebody new in the Christian faith here? You're just getting off the ground. This is very much for you, but it's also for those of us who've been at it for years. And last week, as we listened to John Stott expounding Matthew 5, verse 20, we were beginning to understand the bombshell effect of Christ's words when he told his unsophisticated audience that unless their righteousness exceeded that of the scribes and Pharisees, who at that time were the moral conscience of Israel, the gates of heaven would be barred to them. In our next few studies, we'll be seeing how this principle is developed. First of all, Jesus applies himself to the straightforward commandment about murder. Now, have you got the Bible open? Have a look at it there, page 5. Please help the preacher. Keep the Bible open. Let's have a look at this passage. "You have heard that it was said to the men of old, 'You shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment.'" You have heard, said Jesus. Not "it is written," or "you've read," but "you've heard." And then in verse 22, the "but." This pattern recurs throughout the rest of the chapter. What is Jesus contrasting his own authority here with? Quite definitely, he's not setting his own authority against that of the Old Testament. We learned that, I hope, last week. Verse 17, he hadn't come to supersede or abolish the Ten Commandments, but to uphold and fulfill them. What he's combating in these sentences is the traditions and the interpretations of the commandments that the scribes and Pharisees had overlaid them with, and so blunting them, reducing them in the process. Years ago, there was an actress called Jane Mansfield who was known for a very flamboyant lifestyle. The Sunday papers were always full of revelations about her. She made the news one day by declaring in public, "I live up to the Ten Commandments 100%. Now, there are those who go through the checklist of these commandments and they tick them off one by one. "No, I don't steal. No, I haven't killed anybody." And so on. And that seemed to be the Pharisees' approach. Verse 21 doesn't read too badly in one way. You've heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But even in that second half of the sentence, there's a blunting element present. And our commentators tell us that the term liable to judgment was a reference made to the human courts, more than to the judgment of Almighty God. They were saying something like, if you commit murder, you'll be in danger of being punished by the civil magistrates. There's a sudden blunting there. The original was just, you shall not kill. Period. Full stop. So Jesus, as he expands on the inadequacy of the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees and applies it to the sixth commandment, poses three situations to his believers, the listeners, you and me, and turns them into timeless principles. The first is this. Here it is. One, the spirit is preferable to the letter when it comes to the law of God. The spirit is preferable to the letter of the law. Look again at verses 21 and 22. You've heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council. And whoever says you fool shall be liable to the hell of fire. Christ here is contrasting the Pharisees' interpretation and traditions with which they had surrounded the law with his own authoritative unfolding of what the law of God really and truly meant. Had the Pharisees only taken it in, they would have understood that in the Old Testament, the prophets had been preaching this very thing centuries earlier, that the spirit of the law is what matters, rather than the wooden obeying of its letter. So again, we were reminded last week of Jeremiah 31, 33. Let's remember where to find that in the future. Jeremiah 31, 33. I will put my law, says God, within them, and I will write it on their hearts. That was the intention from the start. And Ezekiel 36, 26 and 27. God says, a new heart I will give you, and a new spirit I will put within you. It's internalized. And I will take out of your flesh the heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh, and I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes. It's the principle of the internalizing of the law of God. God putting his spirit there so it is written on our hearts, in our thinking, in our mindset. So as Christ unfolds the very principles that the prophets have been speaking of, the real nature of murder emerges. It's something that springs out of the heart. So anger harbored against another is, in the eyes of God, he says, equivalent to murder. Now the Pharisees had made a very neat little boundary around the law against murder, and this meant that they felt very secure, and those who followed along with them. Didn't the rich young ruler feel the same in Luke chapter 18, verse 21? When he said about the commandments, all these I have kept from my youth up. Yes, as far as the letter of the law was concerned, I suppose he had. Wasn't Paul the apostle, before he was converted, able to boast, Philippians 3 verse 5, that regarding the law, he was a Pharisee, as he put it, and so a blameless man. I live up to the Ten Commandments 100%. Now here is Jesus saying that to nurse anger against someone is to commit murder against them. That's what God says. You think evil of somebody else? Harbor that grudge? You've murdered them. You've broken the commandment. These phrases in verse 22 about the liabilities that anger deserves have puzzled Bible readers over the centuries. I've gone through about 12 commentaries trying to see what the commentators say about those sentences about the council and about the hell of fire and so on. Why should the person who insults his brother or sister, as the case may be liable to the judgment of the local synagogue. That's what he's talking about. And then the person who insults his brother. The word in the original is the epithet raka, meaning something like dimwit, blockhead, nitwit. It's that sort of feel to the word. Why should the person who insults his fellow be liable to the next court higher up, the Sanhedrin? And why should the person who says, you fool, be liable to what again in the Greek original refers to Gehenna, that is the rubbish tip in the Valley of Hinnom outside Jerusalem, where a perpetual bonfire was kept going to burn up the unwanted offal and the leftovers, the throw-out material from the city? Why does Jesus put it like that? In point of actual fact, everybody listening to Jesus knew very well that nobody who insulted another or was angry in their heart with another person was going to be hauled before the local council for such a thought or word. I thought long and hard about it. All yesterday was in my mind, what is this all about? And I come to the tentative conclusion that Jesus here, as he uses these three very Jewish expressions of retribution, is using them as figurative terms to emphasize that in the sight of God, even to harbor anger in your heart against another will bring its deserts. But it's couched in figurative, colloquial language. Much as today, we might say, look, if you do that, you're going to be put on the mat. That's how we English say it. You'll be put on the mat. You'll be carpeted. Or we might say, the person who does that deserves to be shot. There's something along those lines, I think. In other words, we're not going to get away with it. God says that. Jesus says that. God takes notice. And Christ is here using these figurative terms that his Jewish listeners would understand. You're going to be had up. You're going to be put on the mat. You'll be judged. Well, we understand this from the rest of the New Testament. 1 John 3, verse 15, anyone who hates his brother is a murderer. That's what the New Testament says. That is the teaching of Jesus. So Christ here is amplifying the meaning of that commandment, you shall not kill, and saying, this is what it actually means. You say something against somebody else, it expresses the anger in your own heart, you insult them in some way. Eddie Gibbs, who used to work with the Bible Society here in this country, said, trying to take words back is as impossible as trying to force toothpaste back into the tube after squeezing it too hard. There's a Chinese proverb, speaking without thinking is like shooting without taking aim. You and I are all guilty. There's not a person in this church who's not guilty of murder in that sense. We say something, we think something, and behind it is the thought, I wish you were dead. There only may be a momentary flash, but we've killed them. We're guilty. There's nobody here is not guilty. There's a solidarity about this here. If we come to the table with the bread and wine in a few minutes, we're all going to feel that. A lot of us. So Christ is saying the spirit is preferable to the letter. That is what counts. Secondly, obedience is preferable to sacrifice. Obedience is preferable to sacrifice. Look on at the next little episode, 23 and 24, would you? So if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Did that speak to the Pharisees of the day? Yes, it did. The Pharisees were making the disastrous mistake of thinking that you can cover your sins by taking part in religious ceremonial. You've done something wrong? Then in that case you better go and make a sacrifice, observe at the temple, and that'll put you right. They were always going to the temple. They were always observing the sacrifices, etc. They were meticulous. You think of the story of the Pharisee and the tax collector in Luke 18. Of the tax collector who knows he's a sinner and a rotter. And the Pharisee who knows no such thing about himself, but says before God, I fast twice in the week, I give tithes of all that I possess, I do this and that and the other, I. So it's not a question of trying to balance the scales, setting off all my misdeeds by the good deeds that I can pile onto the other scale, the other end, hoping that it'll tip the balance for me. It's not that at all. In 1 Samuel 15, the king Saul was required in his conflict against the Amalekites to leave nothing after the battle was over. All the property was to be destroyed, the booty, the cattle, the sheep, the goats, everything was to be destroyed. He disobeyed. He kept some back. Then Samuel the prophet comes along and says, have you done everything you should? Oh yes, I've done everything. Then he said, what does this mooing of the cattle mean that I can hear all around me? The bleating of the sheep. Oh, so it's all right, I kept some back because I'm going to make a sacrifice to God with them. And Samuel scolds him in the name of God and says, 1 Samuel 15 verse 22, here's a great principle. Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, here's the principle. To obey is better than sacrifice. That thunders its way through the Old Testament. Now it's here in the New Testament. So here in Matthew chapter 5, you imagine that person in the worship place. Yes, in today's terms, he would be in church, thinking, I just want to have my time of ritual and quiet and building up my spiritual life. And God says to him, but there's somebody who's got something against you. You've hurt them. You've harmed them. They've got it against you. Have you put that right? Go and put it right. Go and put it right now. Otherwise, all the prayers are not going to help you. They won't do anything. Oh, there's a grand story of the time when Stuart Hamblin, who was a man in show business in the United States years ago, was getting his life put right. At 3 o'clock in the morning, he rang up the evangelist, Billy Graham, who he'd got to know a little bit. He said, can I come and talk with you? Billy Graham said, yes. So at 3 o'clock they met. And Stuart Hamblin said to Billy Graham, I want you to pray for me. Billy Graham said, no, I won't. Stuart Hamblin said, you mean? You're a man of God, you won't pray for me? And Billy Graham replied, this all comes out in the biography, said, I'm not going to pray for you until you get down on your knees and acknowledge you've been wrong. When you do that, I'll gladly pray. But until you do that, all the prayers in the world are not going to help you at all. Was that finally pinned him down, helped him? It's this matter of the thing that is wrong in one's heart, then to obey God is better than all the religious observance in the world. That's the principle that's coming out here. He's still dealing with the issue of anger and hatred and resentment. Somebody's got something against you, then let's put it right. Before you start thinking about offering sacrifices and bringing in the collection and helping in your Christian service. So the spirit is preferable to the letter, and obedience is preferable to sacrifice. And lastly, action, urgent action, is preferable to judgment. Look at verses 25 and 26. Here's Jesus speaking again in a figurative term. Make friends quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. It's a little cameo that Jesus gives them again, saying, imagine that you're on the way to court. There's the person. You're going to court and it's all going to be up before the magistrate. Wouldn't it be wiser to settle it out of court? Quickly, now, before you get judged, put into jail, and you pay up everything. Action, urgent action, is preferable to judgment. That's the principle that's coming through. And so to procrastinate, to put it off, isn't going to help the situation. Procrastination is my sin. It gives me endless sorrow. I really must stop doing it. In fact, I'll start tomorrow. Well, that's so with all of us. We all know things that have... You can let a thing build up for even months and years, not have it put right. Christ is speaking to his listeners, but he's speaking to us as well. What's he speaking about? Well, he's speaking about the things that are not right in relationships. The hatred that actually is really, in God's sight, murder. That these things have to be put right. Quickly, quickly, quickly. They've got to be put right in the fellowship. They've got to be put right in individual relationships. Action is preferable to judgment. They say in Africa that when you point the finger at somebody else, you must be very, very careful. Because as you point the finger at somebody else in judgment, there are three fingers pointing back at yourself. You may find yourself on the receiving end of judgment. What is the cause of so much of the stagnation in much of Western Christian life? Gossip. Gossip, and the tearing of each other to shreds, and their reputation. It's killing many churches. It destroys a great deal of evangelical Christianity. Not only in the West, but all over the world. And the Christians are not loving each other as we're meant to. And if we can't love each other, then we cannot allow our love to spill out and go on into the world. Is somebody else's reputation safe in your hands? It's one of the tests. It was the 4th century Roman emperor, Julian, who declared that the kindness which Christians showed, yes, to strangers as well as to each other, was one of the principal causes of Christianity's sensational spread. There's nothing stronger than love in action. When it takes hold of a fellowship, that fellowship becomes an unstoppable force. But if it isn't in charge of a fellowship, the fellowship is not a fellowship. Jesus Christ is not there. It's rather a terrifying passage about anger and murder and judgment. But rather than end on a negative note, let's end on the positive. See, even though Wesley and Whitfield, the great evangelists of old, didn't agree at all points during their ministry of the 18th century, they discouraged their followers from spreading criticism about the other. One small-minded disciple asked Wesley one day, "Do you think that we shall see Mr. Whitfield in heaven?" "No," replied Wesley. And the man looked rather pleased that he'd aimed his flattery well. "No, sir," said Wesley, "I fear not. Mr. Whitfield will be so near the throne, and we at such a distance, we shall hardly get a sight of him." Now let's learn from these great men who show us how to do it. One evening in the last century, D.L. Moody, the great evangelist, showed people how to do it. Here on the platform he'd spoken about the high standards required of a true minister. Then he castigated, in this minister's meeting, the low standards in many ministers. And a young, bright and upcoming theological student blurted out from the front seat, "Mr. Moody, I don't see any such ministers as you describe." Moody snapped back, "You will, young man, if you live long, tarry in Jericho till your beard be grown." And he developed his argument a bit more. Everybody went brittle. The young man wilted. And then as the talk ended, Moody got to the end. He paused. He said, "Friends, I want to confess before you all that I made a great mistake at the beginning of this meeting. I answered my young brother down there foolishly. I asked God to forgive me. I asked him to forgive me." And before anybody could understand what was happening, the greatest evangelist in the world had rushed down from the steps and went to the young man in the front, shook his hand, and asked for forgiveness. So he'd learnt the hardest word in all of Earth's language. "I am sorry." Well, we must learn that from these people who show us how. Spurgeon once said, when he was talking about covetousness, how it takes hold of our lives, and he said, "This ill-natured vice shows itself generally in finding fault." George Beverly Shea, the singer who a few weeks ago was standing here singing for us, was one of Billy Graham's team members. He's always known for his kindness of attitude. And he said it was shared around in our family. He said, my mother never criticized anybody. He said, one day when we were young, my sister Lois said, you notice that mother never speaks ill of anybody. I'm going to get her tonight at the dinner table. You wait. So we waited. Lois said, mother, what do you think of the devil? And mother came back with a reply, I sure admire his persistence. Well, perhaps I was taking it a little far, but there are people who show us how it's done. The person who shows us most of all is Christ. He shows us how it's done. For what do we read there in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21? He suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, no guile was found on his lips. When he was reviled, he did not revile in turn. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but he trusted to him who judges justly. He is the great example. He is the one who preaches this sermon to us this morning, to us all, every single one here. What does he say? Well, we learn from him that the spirit is preferable to the letter. Obedience is preferable to sacrifice. Action is preferable to judgment. When that takes hold of a place, be it fellowship group, church, Christian union group, whatever it is, you have an unstoppable force. As Sir Henry Holland, the great missionary eye surgeon in India of old, once said, if we Christians don't outlive and outlove, we don't deserve to win.